the jungle, the lion sleeps tonight.
We are all being recorded now.
Sorry.
They got it right quiet. The whole world bigger. Okay. This morning, and actually for next week as well, I don't think the next week after that, but for this week and next week, we're going to be looking at wisdom literature, and we're going to end up in the New Testament. But today we're going to begin an introduction and look at what is wisdom literature in the Old Testament or the Hebrew Scriptures, and I'm not an expert in this, and I know there might be people in here who have things to contribute or to even override me, so make sure you speak up and let's set the record straight. But so before we start, let's pray. Lord, thank you for today. Thank you for the Shabbat. Thank you for your rest. We think about things that are going on in our world. With the tsunami and the earthquake in Japan, and also in the Middle East, people who have died or dying. We think of Mary Gardner, who was killed this week here in Jerusalem, and we grieve, and we ask you to comfort us, show us your peace. Help us to be light here in the darkness to those who have no hope. And speak to us through your word now, through your Holy Spirit. In your name we pray, Jesus. Amen. So this is kind of an appropriate topic as well. Let's ask the question, what's wisdom? How would you describe wisdom from English or from a practical point of view, or what?
I think it's equated with the fear of the Lord, because it says it's the beginning.
Okay, right. In Proverbs it says it's the fear of the Lord, but how would you describe it to someone that doesn't know the Bible? If you're just talking in a conversation, what is wisdom?
Helpful truth.
Helpful truth that does what?
That helps.
Okay.
It's moral. Instead of just purely science, it's moral. It's not knowledge. It's something.
But is it moral? Like, I'm not talking about the Bible. I'm just talking about when we talk about it in English.
Experience of someone.
It's like usually you think of an older person.
Good
has
advice.
Experience, good advice, a bird in the hand is worth two in the bush. I think that was supposed to be Benjamin Franklin. And so something that someone's experienced and seen, and good judgment, discernment. In the Bible, in the ancient Near East, was wisdom. Margaret, you brought up the fear of the Lord. What's some other... There's one word that applies to wisdom in the Bible, generally.
Chokhmah, like to do laws.
It's not so much about discernment. I mean, part of it is discernment, part of it is good judgment, but it's about knowledge. Mm-hmm. Knowledge is a big subject in the Bible, and it also applies to wisdom literature. It's
an understanding and enlightenment and all those.
Right, which is all around knowledge. Right, because Hosea talks about... the people,
which is back to the experience idea,
the lack of knowledge.
Gary, in the Bible, is there such a delineation between knowledge and wisdom as we do in our modern world? Like,
no, I don't. From what I've been reading, no.
And the wisdom of Solomon, you know, wisest man in the world.
Right.
So he knew everything and had
exactly.
Discernment, plus knowing everything.
Exactly, they go hand in hand, and it's not just like trivial pursuit knowledge where you know things that you can win the game show. Or the quiz, it's how the world is set up. the knowledge of there's patterns in the world. There's things that underline what we see, how the environment and nature function. Its knowledge is fixed, it's static, and it's something that's passed down from generation to generation of the wise men or the sages. And it's hidden. Like, for instance, go to Proverbs chapter 2. Proverbs 2, verse 3. Knowledge is hidden, but much of it can be discovered or known. Proverbs chapter 2, starting in verse 2. Make your ear attentive to wisdom, incline your heart to understanding. For if you cry for discernment, lift your voice for understanding. If you seek her as silver and search for her as for hidden treasures, then you will discern the fear of the Lord and discover the knowledge of God. So, you know, it's a hidden treasure. It's not something that anyone can just grab. You have to seek it to acquire it.
I think at the end of verse 5, it really stands out to me as being an example of wisdom.
The knowledge of God. Yeah, exactly.
The knowing, you know, the deeper relationship. And not just relationship, but, you know, knowing his ways, like you were talking about, things that are eternal, things that are tested.
Right.
Not just what's put on the top 10 bestseller in whatever country.
Right. Yeah, something.
You talked about grasp. If it's something like God's ways, I think you have to walk in them to start to know them.
Right.
It's more than just grasping.
You have to experience it.
Yeah.
Which is all part of knowing. Mm-hmm. I mean, Adam knew his wife Eve, and she had a kid.
Right. So even
very experiential.
Even biblical mm-hmm. terminology for husband and wife to know each other is the same. Yeah.
Why do you think it says wisdom has built her house? That's a proverb something. 8?
Yeah.
What's the idea of building there?
I think it's Proverbs 9. Is it 8? Sorry, okay.
Late 8.
Late 8.
Because 7 is the Isha Zara.
Right. So knowledge is, it's hidden. It's static. It's been established since before creation. Look at Proverbs chapter 3, verse 19. The Lord by wisdom founded the earth. By understanding, he established the heavens. By his knowledge, the deeps were broken up and the skies drip with dew. By wisdom, the Lord founded the earth. Psalm 92, verse 6.
The senseless man does not know.
Right, nor does the stupid man understand this, that when the wicked sprouted up like grass, all who did iniquity flourished. Or in verse 5, how great are your works, O Lord, your thoughts are very deep. So this whole psalm here is kind of about God's, his creation and how there's a difference between knowing and not knowing. This kind of brings us to the next subject of folly or foolishness and knowledge. In English, what do we think of when we think of a fool? What's a fool in our everyday usage?
Lacking judgment.
Someone that goes against good advice.
Okay, no, in the Bible, that's what it is. I mean, but
well, all included is how
yeah, you're right. It is, but we also kind of think of clowns. We think of
stupid,
just
we have
stupid,
a lot of other adjectives.
Silly. Right. Is a big part of it.
Yeah,
April Fools.
Yeah, silliness.
But the bigger yeah.
Silliness, easily
tricked.
Easily tricked,
like a child.
Like a child, and then someone that goes against good advice.
Right.
He's
right.
A fool.
Exactly.
Oh, fickle.
And that's more of what the Bible
only
is.
A fool would visit Azza these days.
Right. Or ride a bus in Jerusalem. But
people can say that.
Right. No, I know. It's
the foolish people.
Right. It's a value judgment. But in the Bible, more specifically, fool is one who goes against knowledge, who has the opportunity to accept knowledge.
The foolish say that.
But rejects knowledge. And what is the knowledge again? It's something from internal, something from within the soul. Whereas the foolish is something superficial, something on the outside that's connected to the world's vices. It's rejecting the fear of the Lord, rejecting the knowledge of the Lord, and going against it.
Or maybe even rejecting that there is a Lord.
Or even rejecting that there is a Lord, like an atheist, you could say. So it's not necessarily about like a child who just doesn't know any better. It's more of a person who has the opportunity but turns it down. So it's much more, I guess, premeditated, I would say, where you've actually thought about it and you said no.
Like in Proverbs 1:22, it says in this translation, "Foolish people, how long do you want to be foolish? How long will you enjoy pouring scorn on knowledge?"
Yep, exactly. Proverbs 1:22. How was wisdom packaged in the Bible? There's three main books in the Bible that are associated with wisdom literature, this certain genre. What are they?
Proverbs.
Ecclesiastes. And
Songs.
Job.
Job. Yeah.
Song of Songs or Song of Songs.
Five Course Traces.
Is more of a.
Some other, like you read a psalm this morning as well.
Right, and there are some, it's debated, right? But they call them wisdom influencer.
Right. Yeah.
So, Proverbs, Job, and Ecclesiastes are what we're going to look at very briefly this morning. Next week, we're going to look at the continuation of that tradition, and we'll end up in the New Testament. But this morning, we're going to focus on Proverbs, Job, and Ecclesiastes. So, if we want to talk about this wisdom literature that we find in Proverbs, Job, and Ecclesiastes, what's the point or the purpose of these writings, wisdom literature? I mean, we've already kind of talked about wisdom, so what would wisdom literature be about?
Wisdom.
Summarize it.
Summarize wisdom. Oh, the summary of. Is that what you're saying? Yep, the summary of wisdom.
Right, which is how to live your life right, right? How to make right choices, moral choices that lead to prosperity, productivity, and life. And the opposite is the wicked who choose folly or choose to reject God's knowledge and suffer the consequences that leads to death. Let's just look at a couple examples. If you go to Proverbs, in Proverbs chapter 1, verse 7. Actually, let's just read the beginning of Proverbs. "The Proverbs of Solomon, the son of David, king of Israel. To know wisdom and instruction, to discern the sayings of understanding, to receive instruction and wise behavior, righteousness, justice, and equity, to give prudence to the naive, the youth, knowledge, and discretion. A wise man will hear and increase in learning, and a man of understanding will acquire wise counsel, to understand a proverb and a figure, the words of the wise and their riddles. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge. Fools despise wisdom and instruction." So here in the introduction of Proverbs, probably that verse 7, you could circle that verse. That is probably the best summary of this entire book. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge, and fools despise wisdom and instruction. And so there's the knowledge, the wise will choose it, and the fools will reject it. Look at verse 22. "How long, O naive ones, will you love being simple-minded?" Sharon had just read this. "And scoffers delight themselves in scoffing, and fools hate knowledge." So again, the fools hate knowledge. Look at verse 29. "Because they hated knowledge and did not choose the fear of the Lord. again, they hate knowledge. We go to chapter 9. Verse 1. Wisdom has built her house. She has hewn out her seven pillars. She has prepared her food. She has also mixed her wine. She has also set her table. She has sent out her maidens. She calls from the tops of the heights of the city. Whoever is naive, let him turn in here. To him who lacks understanding, she says, come, eat of my food and drink of the wine I have mixed. Forsake your folly and live, and proceed in the way of understanding. He who corrects a scoffer gets dishonor for himself, and he who reproves a wicked man gets insults for himself. Do not reprove a scoffer, he will hate you. Reprove a wise man, and he will love you. Give instruction to a wise man, and he will still be wiser. Teach a righteous man, and he will increase his learning. Again, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, and the knowledge of the Holy One is understanding. And then we go to verse 13. The woman of folly is boisterous. She is naive and knows nothing. She sits at the doorway of her house or on a seat by the high places of the city, calling to those who pass by, who are making their path straight. Whoever is naive, let him turn in here. And to him who lacks understanding, she says, stolen water is sweet, bread eaten in secret is pleasant, but he does not know that the dead are there. Her guests are in the depths of Sheol. So we have a very vivid picture of two paths, one leading to life and one leading to death. One has wisdom leading to the life, and the other one has folly leading to death. What's this remind us of in the biblical tradition? Which book in the Bible?
Lidache?
Or, I'm talking about the Hebrew tradition.
The Hebrew Bible.
Yeah, the Hebrew Bible.
Deuteronomy.
Right. We all know Deuteronomy. Real quick, let's go to Deuteronomy. Maybe chapter 30. Deuteronomy 30, verse 15. This is throughout Deuteronomy, but I'm just going to point out real quick these verses. Deuteronomy 30, 15. See, I have set before you today life and prosperity and death and adversity. And that I command you today to love the Lord your God, to walk in his ways and to keep his commandments and his statutes and his judgments, that you may live and multiply. Verse 17. But if your heart turns away, you will not obey, but are drawn away and worship other gods and serve them, I declare to you today that you will surely perish. And you will not, you know, prolong your stay in the land. Verse 19. I call heaven and earth to witness against you today that I have set before you life and death, blessing and curse. So choose life in order that you may live and your descendants. So this is like a Deuteronomistic principle of choosing God's path, which in the earlier books of the Hebrew Bible, it's usually Torah, his instruction, his teaching. And here in Proverbs, it can be, you know, Chokhmah, where it's talking about wisdom. Choosing wisdom is choosing that life and that knowledge. Rejecting it will take you to death. So, wisdom literature is instructing us how to live productive moral lives. Who wrote this stuff and where did it come from? Any ideas, any background?
Do you have a question? Is it the oldest compiled stuff that we have, wisdom literature?
No, not really. Generally, no. There might be some old stuff in it, but
Torah, of course, the Torah traditions would have to be the oldest.
Well, wisdom literature goes way back before the Bible. Wisdom literature is found in all the ancient cultures in Egypt, Sumeria, in Babylon, or what would you call Babylonia at that time? Babylonia?
Syria? Ancient? Akkadian?
Yeah, what do you call that? Akkadian? Babylonia?
I don't know. Mesopotamia?
Mesopotamia. So wisdom literature is a part of all of that. And so the Bible, the writers here in the Bible, they're part of their culture and the genre, and they're also incorporating these writing styles into their writings. And I'm sure you've heard this involved with, say, the creation story in Genesis chapter 1, where people often point out similarities with the Bible's creation story to, say, the Babylonian creation story. And the difference is that the Bible is saying, no, these other gods did not kind of accidentally create the world, but it was done by our God, the Lord, and it was with a clear plan and purpose, and He's in control of everything. And so you can see it in the same way with wisdom in the Bible. It's God's. It's part of God's perfect plan. One of the chief characteristics of wisdom literature is it looks at the trees. It looks at the sun. It looks at the moon. It looks at the stars. It looks at the animals. And it obviously sees there's a creator behind this. There's an intelligent design. I'm not using that for what's being used today in certain circles to debate evolution. But there's obviously an intelligence, and there's a reason and an order behind everything that we see. And it's applying the environment to what ancient Israel understood as who God was, God's character and purposes. So, again, you know, what is the purpose of the Bible in general, whether it's wisdom literature or Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Deuteronomy, all the books of the Bible? What's the purpose? It's to know God. It's to understand God. And so in the end, it's a theology book. It's trying to explain to us who God is and what He's doing in this world. So what were we talking about?
Who writes?
Who writes, yeah. So who are these people that are doing this? Anybody any background in this?
Who?
Someone who knows how to
write. In biblical tradition, who wrote Proverbs? Who wrote Ecclesiastes?
Solomon.
Who wrote Job? Okay, generally we say we see Solomon. Like, for instance, at the beginning of Proverbs 1, we noted it said, the Proverbs of Solomon, the son of David, king of Israel. And also, hold on. Why is that there? Okay. In Ecclesiastes, we turn to Ecclesiastes. Ecclesiastes chapter 1, verse 1 says, the words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. Notice it doesn't say Solomon. It says the son of David, king in Jerusalem. So it doesn't necessarily have to be Solomon. And but tradition has connected Solomon to it. Also in Proverbs, we read the first chapter there where it says, it mentions Solomon by name. But what about the rest of Proverbs? Are there other names mentioned about writers?
Yeah.
Chapter what?
31.
Like, 30. Go to Proverbs chapter 31.
Apparently Solomon didn't know about Ishbosheth. All right.
Proverbs chapter 31, verse 1. The words of King Lemuel, the oracle which his mother taught him. We're not sure who this person is. Some people have connected it to Solomon, but chapter 30, the words of Agur, the son of Yake. Right. So, and also the style mixed together in these Proverbs can be different, of the different chapters. So that's something else. But generally Solomon's connected to these. He's not connected to Job. And why does Solomon get connected to wisdom literature in the Bible? What story of Solomon?
What is that?
Let's go to 1 Kings. Chuck pointed out, Solomon is a wise man. Again, according to the Bible, why are you wise? Fear the Lord, and you accept the knowledge of the Lord, and you follow it out. 1 Kings chapter 3.
You know all about trees too.
After we read this, we're going to ask the question, so was Solomon Was Solomon a wise man, according to the biblical definition?
What's that being?
1 Kings chapter 3. It all starts here in verse 5. Solomon is becoming king, and he has a dream where the Lord appears to him. And he says, you know, what would you like? I'll give you anything. It's kind of like, you know, the genie in the bottle. You get to make 3 wishes. And so we've always thought about how would I answer that question to get the most bang for my buck. And so Solomon could have said, give me wealth, give me power,
give me women,
all of these things. Instead, he says wisdom. And God says, ah, you know, you chose the right answer. Because of that, you get everything else as well. And that is in verse 10. It was pleasing in the sight of the Lord that Solomon had asked this thing. And God said, because you've asked this thing and you've not asked for long life or riches or, you know, to have your enemies, but you've asked for discernment and to understand justice, I will do this and all the rest as well. And then Solomon awakes. Then what do we hear in chapter 4 about Solomon's, who he is? How much wisdom does he have? 1 Kings 4:29. For now God gave Solomon wisdom and very great discernment and breadth of mind like the sand that is on the seashore. Solomon's wisdom surpassed the wisdom of all the sons of the east and all the wisdom of Egypt, for he was wiser than all men. Notice, they mention Egypt. So this is giving you a litmus test or a something to...
Let's see, 4:29.
In English, it's different than Hebrew. This gives you a way to judge Solomon. He's saying Egypt is the gold standard at that time. It is the professional league of wisdom teachers. And so Solomon surpasses Egypt. Verse 31, he's wiser than all men, than, you know, these kind of ancient men that are mentioned, these ancient wise men. And I have no background into any of these people, and they're probably quite lost in the annals of time. Verse 32, he also spoke 3,000 proverbs. In his songs, sometimes people's translations have, and he wrote 3,000 proverbs, but it's really spoke. And that's true in wisdom literature, that you generally aren't making proverbs, you're just passing them on. You're an exceptional student and you're able to take what your teachers have given you and then you pass those on. Obviously you can make interpretations, and I'm sure you can make up your own original proverb as well, but generally the most important task is you need to preserve what has been found out about the invisible, hidden knowledge of God, and preserve it and pass it on. And so 3,000 proverbs, his songs were 1,005. He spoke of trees. So here he is, you know, he's a, it's the Audubon Society in America called. It's a preservation of environment. He spoke of trees from the cedar that is in Lebanon, even to the hyssop that grows on the wall. He's a conservationist, I guess. He spoke also of animals and birds and creeping things and fish. And so all of these things are part of wisdom. They're not, it's not always so much, again, about making a good judgment or discernment. It's about a knowledge of how the world works and environmentally and in nature. Now, we do have an example of his discernment and his judgment in one of the first decisions he makes, right, with the two women and the baby.
Which there's no rules for. So that's interesting. That really is discernment. And that's what he asked for, was discernment to govern these people.
Right, right. And so let's look at that.
In a sense, there is a hidden rule there that he was disclosing. Like the true mother is going to have a bigger bond than the fake one. So it's like under the surface.
Mm-hmm. And Kugel even points out that Solomon doesn't make a ruling about who the true mother is, but that he makes a ruling about who would be the best one to raise the child.
Mm-hmm. Because so he's acting like the true mother.
Exactly, with the right instincts. Like, of course we're not going to give the baby, you know, kill the baby to make this point. It doesn't matter, give it, you know. And so then that would be the one who's got the right attitude and paternal instincts. That's in chapter...
It comes pretty soon after.
Yeah, isn't it chapter 5? Or is it chapter...
I think it's 3:16.
Is it 3:16? Okay, thanks.
It's two prostitutes in my book.
Right, two prostitutes.
I didn't know.
Yeah. Right, the two women who are harlots come to him and say, "We live together, we have two children. She has a child, I have a child. In the night, her child died, and now we only have one child left." And
it said because she lay on him.
Right.
So
she accidentally killed her kid. And so the one woman is saying, "No, this is my child," and the other woman is saying, "No, this is my child." And so Solomon is going to cut the baby in half. Of course, a lot of people say maybe he's not really going to do that. This is just he's using the legal code to talk about if there's property, how to divide it up. But it's his kind of quick discernment of utilizing human emotions with the law. And next week, when we look at Jesus, I think we'll also notice some similarities in how judgments are made in tight spots and quick decisions on what should we do with this. You know, you're on the spot and you have to come up with a quick answer. And speaking of which, when we generally think of wisdom, how it's taught, its form, it's not usually taught as a story. It's usually, how is it given in the Bible? Especially in Proverbs.
Sayings.
It's in a saying or an aphorism where it's very short. It's two lines, maybe. It packs a punch. It's not wordy. Go to Proverbs chapter 10. And often it's a parallelism, which is a type of structure, literary structure. Let's look at chapter 10, verse 1. A wise son makes a father glad, but a foolish son is a grief to his mother. So this is an example of, on one hand, you have the foolish son upsets his parents. Then on the other hand, you have, you know, the foolish son who brings grief to his parents. So this is a parallelism. And it doesn't always have to be exactly the same type of parallelism. For instance, this one is giving you the positive, and then the first line gives you the positive example, and the second line gives you the negative example. There's other ones. And this kind of continues here, chapter 10, verse 3. The Lord will not allow the righteous to hunger, but he will reject the craving of the wicked. Poor is he who works with a negligent hand, but the hand of the diligent makes rich. So positive, negative. There's other examples. Let's see. Where the parallelism,
kind of a continuation.
A continuation. That's the word I was looking for.
About 10:19. Mm-hmm. The more you talk, the more likely you are to sin. If you are wise, you will keep quiet.
Exactly.
The same idea.
It emphasizes it more. And one second.
Where's that one?
That was 19. Proverbs 10:19.
Would be a continuation.
Is that 10:26?
Mm-hmm.
Would you like to read it?
Like vinegar to the teeth and smoke to the eyes, so is a sluggard to those who send him.
Mm-hmm. Very good.
Yeah, like a metaphor and then an interpretation of it.
So, the the teacher is having to, the sage, the chacham, is having to take a big idea, put it quite small, has to concentrate it. And often that shows skill on one hand, that they're able to do that. But for us who are reading these things 2,000-3,000 years later, if they're out of context, they can be difficult to understand. I'm sure you've read some proverbs before that are like, what? It's a little hard to follow. And part of that is we've lost context for some of the proverbs because they've been grouped together in a collection. But the other thing, though, is it can be on purpose, too, to challenge the reader to find the wisdom. Again, remember, you have to search for it. You have to seek it out. You have to experience it, as you said, Margaret, or it doesn't mean anything to you. It's not something that you can just buy at a store and take home with you.
Gary, wasn't the point of God's pleasure in Solomon's request wasn't just that he wanted to amass wisdom to be wise himself, but that he actually had the intent to rule a people, so that he wanted help for an outflowing. Like wisdom, sometimes you have to see it applied. Like you say, if it's cryptic, you have to still want in your heart to understand the full truth behind something that's a little bit cloudy and murky.
Right.
It's the wanting.
It's the search, journey.
And it's the search that you want it because of how you share it. I don't think you can just store it up.
Right.
I think that's what makes wisdom different. Maybe the knowledge.
It's like daily manna. You can't keep it. It'll spoil the next day.
And you want it for the purpose of relating to other people in the world. I think God
right.
is after that.
That was correct. That's the other thing is wisdom literature is looking at how, what's our relationship with nature? How has God put nature in an environment order? And also us as humans on the earth. Why is there righteous and why is there wicked? And how does God interplay between, you know, the black and the white, the two extremes of wickedness and righteousness? Because we all know in reality, none of us are really wicked or righteous. We're kind of in between. I mean, there are the Hitler types and there are the Mother Teresa types that we usually can paint as extremes of, you know, what's good and what's bad. But most of us struggle between these two poles of trying to follow God but failing and choosing wrong sometimes over the good. And so this is about, like you said, about that experience of going along with it. And so this brings us back to Solomon. Let's talk about Solomon, right? He's the wisest man in the world according to 1 Kings. But then what else do we know about him in 1 Kings? What's his legacy?
He really turned away from it in the end.
Right. It says his wives turned his heart towards their idols, and you know, probably the best description of his character would be mediocrity. At the end of his life.
Well, he destroyed the country.
Right.
If you think, if you step back and look generationally, the divided kingdom comes from him.
Right. Right. His son inherited a mess.
His son inherited a mess, his father's misrule, as it were. He had the whole country up in arms, ready to revolt, and they did. And it split. And that's his legacy.
Yeah.
So you could actually be incredibly wise and not act on it.
Incredibly stupid.
Well, to me,
and have the fruits of that.
Well, in the end of his life, he would not call him incredibly wise.
Mm-hmm. Right, but because maybe there's a living, breathing aspect of wisdom. But it's not.
He had left it.
And so this also calls in, not the question, but it calls us to think about these books that have been tied to Solomon. And often some people think these are editorial insertions, you know, of Solomon did this and Solomon did that because of 1 Kings. And yet he as we see, is a kind of a compromised leader. The whole wisdom, so then people start to see, well, maybe Solomon is a patron of wisdom literature. That he, because his kingdom is so huge and so big, there's people coming from all over the world.
He's making a library.
He's making a library. He's bringing in advisors, wise men, sages, whatever you want to call them, to support this endeavor to seek out wisdom. And it's part of who he is. So it's, but of course, 1 Kings also says that Solomon, he himself knew 3,000 Proverbs. And so there's something there, but also it seems that we need to think about wisdom as a circle of advisors. Just like today, whenever you're a president or prime minister, you always have your cabinet or your experts who come to you and advise you on economics or education or whatever the specialty is.
How many women did he have?
It was 1,000, right? 300 concubines and 700 wives.
So that's 1,000. So he had, three proverbs for every woman.
What's that song about?
Money better to have more proverbs.
What's that one song about 50 ways to leave a lover?
Yeah.
So yeah, 3 proverbs for each one.
Could it be that his extreme wealth that came as a result of his wisdom was actually his undoing?
Yeah.
Because Christ Jesus extreme. Said how hard it was for a rich man. Yeah. And I think the wealth brought him such personal security
right.
that he stopped trusting in the Lord.
Yeah, I think next week when we look at Jesus, I think he'll allude, I think, to Solomon. Often, or quite a few times, maybe, like you're saying.
Here, you know that verse. I think it's a verse that says, "Don't let your good be evil spoken of." I've always wondered what that really meant. Like the liberalness, like Solomon had all this stuff from God, and he had a liberality that he understood from God, who blessed him, and he extended himself in a way he shouldn't have. You know, he took in all these wives he never should have.
He also had high taxes.
What did he do?
High taxes. That's what really got the people agitated.
Yeah.
You know, when his son came around, they said, lower taxes, and his son didn't. So it shows you that Solomon had high taxes. And it talks about, you know, he used to have these huge feasts, and gold was on everything. So you're right. He had his lavish lifestyle. Wasn't working as a...
But you know, the liberality side of God's goodness and the wealth and everything, like you say, I wonder if there's an admonition that you should always really try to hone in your life a little bit and not understand how, like when it says, don't let your good be evil spoken of, I wonder if that's an idea there that you can actually exploit God in a wrong way. And other people can watch that and they say, how could you do that? Like,
so you're saying about today?
There's something about wisdom and liberality, and I have a person at this table I think is a very wise person. It's my husband. He's, when people ask him for advice, he gives it freely. There's never any money or any kind. It's a virtue just to share what he knows, and that's always blessed me. And I'm just wondering how you could be so blessed of God and still miss it like Solomon did.
Right.
Surely he must have seen. And he's going wrong. If he was so wise, he must have known he was doing something wrong.
I think you choose not to live for wisdom. I prefer to be precious first and foremost. I mean, I think whether rich or poor, we have that choice.
Yeah. It's a constant choice.
I think a poor person could be just as unwise as Solomon. Not the effect, of course, or of kingdoms, but he could leave a legacy of destruction, just like Solomon.
Right.
And I think just because you don't do that, you don't make it of your own volition, your own choice to hold, to act. You know, everything that he either gathered or said himself, you choose to lay aside, that you didn't retain it, that you didn't hold it like precious.
Right.
It lost its preciousness in the light either of your lack or your affluence.
What is the,
oh, And it's just as far as Solomon, there's two things that have always just stuck out to me when I read them. And the first one's in 1 Samuel, well, actually the first one's Deuteronomy 15. And the second one's in 1 Samuel 8, where Samuel describes, you're asking for a king, here's what he's going to do.
Right.
And it reads like, here's what Solomon did. Then even, to me, even more dramatic is the one in Deuteronomy 17.
Don't. Right.
You know, he says, moreover, this time about the king, he shall not keep many horses or send people back to Egypt to add to his horses. You shall not go back that way. He shall not have many wives, lest his heart go astray, nor shall he amass silver and gold to excess. And yet when you read the descriptions of what Solomon did, it's like, here it is. Right. This is what, you know, and whichever way you date it, it doesn't matter, because it's very clear that the author is saying, you know, that these things are being linked together. Solomon is the epitome of this thing that Deuteronomy forbids.
What is that, 17 what?
It starts with, kind of starts with 16.
I shouldn't say just richness
or 15, I'd say.
Everything in between.
No, chapter 17, verse 15.
Because again, no one's like, generally no one's super, super rich, no one's super, super poor in our world. Generally, you know, we all are somewhere in the middle, maybe a little further this way or a little further that way. And
all in great need of not only obtaining, but holding precious wisdom.
Right.
And living it.
So anyways, Bill, I just comment here. It's interesting how the Bible has that. It's obvious, mm-hmm. if you know your Bible, that this is about Solomon. And yet, Solomon is also talked about as being the great king.
Right.
And it's funny how the Bible holds that together and just keeps it there. Mm-hmm. And we have to somehow deal yeah. with it.
Would it be interesting to discern when Ecclesiastes was written? Because it seems as though he comes to the conclusion after all the things he's experienced, all the wealth, all the things mm-hmm. that everybody else thinks is so wonderful that it's all vanity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the only thing is to know the Lord and to follow His commandments. That's the conclusion he comes up with.
Right.
Maybe at the end of his life he repented and understood,
right.
learned from his mistakes or not. But,
and I think that's also why they've connected Ecclesiastes to Solomon.
Right.
It's because tradition somehow needs to redeem Solomon. You know, like, let's give him Ecclesiastes so that at least he's repentant at the end.
Mm-hmm.
And that makes great sense, because it's much easier to swallow than his life if Ecclesiastes is how he ends it. Let's go to Ecclesiastes real quick. Probably, though, Solomon probably didn't write Ecclesiastes. There's a lot of reasons to date it much later than Solomon, mm-hmm. and Randy could give you those, I think.
A couple of Persian words, for instance.
There's a couple of words that date to the Persian period, which are 500 years after Solomon.
And, you know, people try to argue that somehow they got in during Solomon's day, but when you weigh probabilities, there's no reason for words that are from that entered Aramaic and became normal in Second Temple times, jumped 500 years back.
Right.
Never being part of the language.
Back earlier, you mean.
Right. Yeah. In other words, in order for Solomon to have written the book of Qohelet, then some of these Persian words, and there's a list of a bunch of words also that show up in Mishnaic Hebrew that are not in other First Temple Hebrew things, that are suspicious, and some of the syntax is suspicious, and there's lots of she, which is again part of
Mishnaic
Hebrew, and some people would say, well, it was Northern Kingdom, fine, but Solomon's from Jerusalem, and so for Solomon to be quoting stuff from Northern Hebrew that happens to line up perfectly with Mishnaic Hebrew, and lots of words that show up in Mishnaic Hebrew and these Persian words, when you add that all up, it looks like we have a Second Temple writing. And we do know that in the Second Temple we have a lot of writings where people would write the book to sound like someone in antiquity.
Are there any other the suspicions and what it looks like? Are there any other reasons or places that can lead you, other than that it's just this time period? Does it make you think of anything else?
That dates it, is what she's saying.
No, the only thing that...
It's language is what you brought up so far.
Yeah, the language. Well, the language is the thing that dates it. The purpose of it is probably related to the reputation of Solomon as the wisest. It never actually says Solomon.
Right.
It says a son. It says, you know, one of the kings, you know, of the kings before me.
Remember that,
was.
And it doesn't mean a king necessarily, as we think it could be a governor of,
well,
of Judea.
Well, but if it says kings, there's only two kings before Solomon. There was David and Saul. So that sounds a little bit funny anyway. It sounds like something being written later, and the whole book, because of that distancing, it has the feel of somebody using Solomon, or perhaps a composite of Solomon and Hezekiah and Josiah.
Mm-hmm. That's kind of what I was talking about, other outcomes of those suspicions. You know, like, it looks like this.
It's a composite of the best of the kings. So you could take Solomon and Hezekiah and Josiah and have them in your mind as the ideal king that's writing this. And that's what I think. To me, there's no doubt that is how the book was written and how it was intended right from the very beginning. But if someone wanted to doubt, then they could say, well, it's only 99.9 something certain that it's from the Second Temple. But
well, let's look at the end of Ecclesiastes. Well, maybe let's look at the beginning and then we'll look at the end real quick. Ecclesiastes chapter 1, and then we're going to finish with this. Let's go to verse 12. I, the preacher, and this is where Kohelet comes from, preacher, Kohelet. I have been the king over Israel and Jerusalem, and I set my mind to seek and explore by wisdom concerning all that has been done under heaven. It is a grievous task which God has given to the sons of men to be afflicted with. I have seen all the works which have been done under the sun, and behold, all is vanity and striving after wind. What is crooked cannot be straightened, and what is lacking cannot be counted. And, you know, you think of the tsunami in Japan. You think of the earthquake in Haiti a few years ago, and just the tragedies that are out there, you think, you know, these things happen. How can we straighten what's crooked? Verse 16, I said to myself, behold, I have magnified and increased wisdom more than all who were over Jerusalem before me. And my mind has observed a wealth of wisdom and knowledge. And I set my mind to know wisdom and to know madness and folly. So here's that clear distinction, you know, what is the knowledge of the Lord and what is the rejection of that? What is that foolishness, that folly? And I realized that this also is striving after one, because in much wisdom there's much grief, and increasing knowledge results in increasing pain. And we don't have time to go into, well, what does that mean? Because this is a deep book with, I'm sure, all the postmodern poets and artsy people would be, love this book, because there's a lot that you can pull out of it. Because most artists create art from pain, some type of experience that you've had. And that's what Ecclesiastes is. It's word art that comes from pain. And so you know, I've set my mind to know wisdom. So this Kohelet, this preacher, he is a sage or a wise man. Why do we know this? Go to the end of Ecclesiastes, chapter 12, verse 9. He's experienced it all, and that's why it would make sense for Solomon to be the writer, at least figuratively, because of his life experience of wrong choices and pain and and all of that. But in a verse, so this is Ecclesiastes chapter 12, verse 9. In addition to being a wise man, chacham, that's the Hebrew word, the Kohelet, the preacher, also taught the people knowledge. So again, wisdom literature is associated with knowledge. And he pondered, searched out, and arranged many proverbs. Just like we said before, the teacher would take proverbs that have been given to him by his teachers and then pass them on to the people and to his students. Verse 10, the preacher sought to find delightful words and to write words of truth correctly. So it's not just that the teacher is a robot, like a computer that, you know, input in, input out, but actually you have to be a good teacher, you have to, or a good writer, or you have to be able to put it in a way that the people can connect with and understand. So that's why you have to interpret things. You can't just give information. You have to put it into pictures, put it into practical use. People can apply it, which is what verse 10 is saying. Verse 11, the words of wise men are like goads, and the masters of these collections are like well-driven nails. They are given by one shepherd. So a piece of wisdom that is so powerful and has so much meaning is like a nail that you pound in the wood. It's sharp and to the point, and it goes straight in when it's hit correctly, if it's done right. Right? Verse 12, but beyond this, my son, be warned, the writing of many books is endless. An excessive devotion to books is wearing to the body. We could preach a whole sermon on that. Verse 13, today it would be the internet. Using the internet is endless, and excessive devotion to the internet is wearing to the body, especially your bottom. Verse 13, the conclusion when all has been heard is fear God and keep his commandments, because this applies to every person. For God will bring every act to judgment, everything which is hidden, whether it is good or evil. And we'll end today here. Let's keep this in mind, this end of Ecclesiastes. This is what a wise man was, what a sage was in the Second Temple period, and this is going to lead into the time of Jesus, of Jesus' tradition. We'll start to notice the way Jesus teaches has a lot of similarities to Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, ideas in Job, and the way he brings it to the people is very compelling and focused on knowing God, choosing to follow God. And so, until next week, Shabbat Shalom.
Thank you.